Everybody, you're listening to season 13, episode 51 of the New World Order. My name's Clat 2. Episode 51 is significant because it's the penultimate episode of the year. After this, we go to 52, and there are 52 weeks of the year, and therefore the show is, I guess, over. It doesn't seem like that's correct to me, but I honestly believe that it is. I have reason to believe that it is, no matter what calendar you use. So, in this episode, I'm going to really quickly talk a little bit about a listener email, but a thing that relates to a thing that we've been talking about. And then we're going to jump right in back into the A package set. And you'll remember, of course, that the previous, I don't know, like it seems like 50 episodes have been about Util Linux. And Util Linux was just in the U, it was snuck into the U section of the A package set on Slackware. And when I started down that path, it just took forever because there were so many little utilities appropriately in the package called Util Linux. But we're out now. We've gotten through all of the package, all the software, all the commands in Util Linux, and now we're back out into the A package set. So the only ones we have left are which, XFS Progs, XZ, and Zoo. That's four applications. So I am feeling pretty good about getting through the A package set by the end of 2019. I'm calling it, I'm saying that's gonna happen. That's pretty exciting, because that means that we're gonna start 2020 with AP, which is just the general application package set. And that's kind of exciting, because I mean, obviously we've been in this one package set since beginning this tour of Slackware Linux. Honestly, it almost feels like it's all just downhill from here. It's like, oh, we got out of the A package set? I mean, what else is there to cover? I have a feeling I won't be feeling that way, 2 weeks into the new year. But right now, it just feels like really we've just gotten through so much. And we have. I mean, we really have. So let's turn our attention to this email that coincidentally just came into my inbox earlier this week, actually. But it's from Zoe at the Free Software Foundation, who actually I had the pleasure of meeting Zoe in person at a FSF meetup in Raleigh, North Carolina, earlier this year. And it was a really, really good meetup. My voice was shot, so I was kind of rasping my way through conversations, but a bunch of great conversations were had there. Met a bunch of cool people who are clearly very forward-thinking and have a lot of exciting plans for the FSF. So it is with almost renewed vigor about the Free Software Foundation itself. Not that it ever really waned, but I really feel a level of confidence in the people that I met and the ideas that they were talking about. And I'm kind of excited about it. And one of the things this email, I mean, I've been excited about it, but one of the emails that came in that I'm going to refer to right now just happens to be very relevant to what we were talking about. Remember, we've been talking about, in response to Michael's listener email, mobile. What do you do about mobile? About free and open source in your mobile device. And I didn't have a great answer, and I still don't have a great answer, honestly. But, you know, part of not having a great answer, ideally, in the open source world is to have something that's in progress, to have that solution available. And that solution, as you probably kind of know, could be Replicant. So if you go to replicant.us, you'll find the website of this initiative that has been launched. I guess it's more than an initiative, it's a project that has been launched to take Android source code and sort of develop essentially a Libre Android distribution, for lack of a more graceful term. But that's what it is. I mean, it's the free version, free and open source version of the Android OS. Now they're rebasing Replicant off of Android 9, which should enable a wider range of users to use a fully free Android distribution for the first time. So that's a big deal. They are seeking to reduce costs of maintenance and just trying to kind of stabilize the project and make sure that it's into to last and to go go forward, regardless of anything else. Like, Replicant should be its own project, right? I mean, we don't know what's going to happen to Android. Android's developing. We don't know what's happening to it. We don't know what direction it's going because it's not fully open. Replicant will be fully open. Ideally, we'll have some level of confidence in its sustainability. And ideally, it will be something that lots of people can use. And I think, as I've said in the previous episodes, I mean, that's kind of one of the big hurdles to the mobile platform, is that the software and the hardware are really, really tightly sort of interwoven, and it's not super easy to just grab any phone. I mean, you cannot go to the store and just grab any phone and bring it home and think, okay, well, now I'll flash some, you know, free and open source software onto it, because you just don't have that level of confidence that there will be a boot ROM for that device. And that's a problem. That's one of the central problems, I think, for me, of the mobile platform. I don't feel like I have control over the platform. And when I don't feel like I have control over a thing that I'm purchasing, oftentimes for over $100, then I have very little interest in it. So Replicant is a big deal. It's an important little initiative, at least insofar as we are assuming that the mobile platform is kind of the future, or at least part of the future. And I think it's more or less relatively safe to assume that. I mean, it's funny because, you know, we're sitting around thinking, oh, it's mobile from now on. Like, that's where everything's going. And yet, I mean, would you have ever said that the iPod itself would have gone away? Like, would you have said that would ever go away back in, 2000 and something, 2003, 4, 5, whatever? I mean, at that time, there was nothing more coveted than an iPod. And I don't think anyone would have ever seen the day that nobody even has, you know, at that point, everyone had a media player, and that was going to be the future. That was the future. Everyone was going to have a media player. And then suddenly the mobile platform became a platform in itself, and media players were redundant within 10 years of being developed. Practically, they were mute. Point is, Replicant is an important project if we're assuming that the mobile platform is part of the future, and they're asking for donations right now. So if you go to replicant.us, you should donate some money for the holidays. If you have nothing better to do with that money, donate it to Replicant. Or alternately, if you, like me, would rather see gifts be just donations to worthy causes, then make that happen, and consider Replicant as one of those targets for your donation. Okay, so let's see. Yeah, you know, I haven't mentioned that lately. Someone did mention that to me on Mastodon. I want to just reiterate, and I should probably put this on the website. I don't know how many people actually go to GNUworldorder.info, but if you ever want to support this show in any way, by all means, give money to the Slackware project. And Slackware has a Patreon page, which I'm pretty sure I have mentioned that before, but they do have a Patreon page at patreon.com/slacklinux. That's Slackware Linux, all one string. patreon.com/slacklinux. Donate to that project, and I will view that in my heart as a donation to this show. Okay, let's start out with the first command of our little short list here, and that would be the which command, WHICH. Oddly enough, we were just not talking about which a couple episodes ago. Remember, in the util Linux package, there was the where is command, and the purpose of the where is command, if you'll recall, was to find an executable binary and a man page for the application that you name. And then I'm pretty sure I even said during that episode, why would someone use this over which? And I guess the more or less obvious answer is, well, you get the binary executable and the man page. And then my immediate thought was, well, why not use which and apropos? However, where is gives you both, so why wouldn't you just use where is? And honestly, the actual reason, at least for me, is that which is 5 letters and where is 7 letters. Guess which one wins? It's Witch. Also, there's just habit, honestly. Habit forces me to use Witch. I may at some point try to switch over to where it is, but let's talk about Witch because that is obviously the one that we're talking about here. So, Witch, it takes one or more argument. For each argument, it prints to standard out the full path of the executables that would have been executed when this argument had been entered at the shell prompt. So, in other words, you type in a command after the word which, and it tells you where it found that command by searching through your path. Of course, your path variable is viewable to you by echo and then space dollar sign PATH, all capitals, and that shows you the path. And you know, this is like one of those sort of introductory exercises that people should have to do, or you know, that one should force one's self to do frequently when first starting out with Linux, because it's just so difficult to understand how those commands actually occur. And you can tell people, well, a command happens. The computer knows what to do when you type in a command because it is searching through your path and finding the first occurrence of the thing that you just typed. But it doesn't really make sense until someone sits down with Witch and types out a couple of things and figures out, okay, now I'm getting it. So when I do Witch find, it tells me that the find command is in slash user slash bin slash find. Got it. So if I type in slash or Witch awk, it tells me it's in user bin awk. Witch install pkg, not found in my path. Why wouldn't it be found in my path? Well, that's because it's not in my normal user path. I have to become root in order for install pkg to be found. And there it is, slash sbin slash install pkg, and so on. That kind of repetition, I think, really does reinforce some of the principles. It doesn't explain the principle necessarily, but it reinforces it. It just kind of drums into your head. If the command is not in your path, then it's not going to be found no matter what you do. And if you have two commands of the same name, then when you type in which and then that command, it returns the one that it has found first, according to the order that your path is written in. Now, there is a way around that, and that's why I jumped to that example. Which dash dash all prints all matching executables in your path, not just the first. So that would be a good way to find, I guess, what I would think of as a collision, but I guess it's technically not a collision. But it's kind of a collision. I don't believe that I have such an example, unfortunately, to drum up. I just tried Python because I was thinking, well, maybe Python might qualify because there's that Python 2 and Python 3, but it's just Python. So anyway, dash dash all shows all matching executables in the path, not just the first one. There's a couple of similar options in which, such as the show tilde or show dot or skip dot and skip tilde. So the skip dot or show dot either skips or shows directories in your path that start with a dot. The skip or show tilde will skip tilde. It will skip directories or show directories that start with a tilde. So that controls sort of, or that rather lifts certain items out of your path if for whatever reason you want to do that. And you might want to, because the dot might, obviously, it would probably indicate some kind of path, some kind of absolute path from your current directory, or maybe even your current directory. I think a lot of people, or some people, may actually have that in their path. And then I don't, but some people do. And then tilde obviously would be the stuff that you've got hanging out in your own home directory, and maybe you're not looking to see if you personally have something installed. You want to see if the system itself has something installed. So there's an interesting little example in the man page for which that kind of tells me that maybe they don't actually mean it to be used the way that I feel I was taught to use it. It's a really interesting example, and I'm just gonna, I'll sort of give you the overview here. No, actually, I'll just give you the example. It's not that much. The recommended way to use this utility is by adding an alias in the C shell or shell function in Bourne shell for which, such as the following. And here's the bash example. Which, curly brace, parentheses, alias, semicolon, declare dash f, close parentheses, pipe, user bin which, dash, rather, dash dash, tty only, which is an option to stop processing options on the right, if not tty, and then dash dash read alias, which is an option to detect, get exactly what it says. It says read alias, read aliases from standard in, reporting matching ones on standard out, okay? Dash dash read functions, which is an option to read shell function definitions from standard in, reporting matching ones on standard out. Dash dash show tilde, dash dash show dot, and then dollar sign, at sign. Close the brace, and then export dash f which. So it's sort of, yeah, it's, I mean, it's creating basically an alias for which. So presumably you would have this, I guess, maybe in your dot dash rc, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's in something else. Maybe it's a dedicated program, I don't know. But there's the which. And then it says, this will print the readable tilde slash and dot slash when starting which from your prompt, while still printing the full path when used from a script. So in their example, they have which Q2, and then it shows tilde slash bin slash Q2, and then echo backtick which Q2 backtick slash home slash example slash bin slash Q2. So I don't know exactly why they're recommending the use case that specifically in their example, and why they wouldn't have built their command to actually work that way. It strikes me as odd, in other words, that the command would be written in such a way that in its man page, it provides you with code to result in what, in how the command ought to be run, or in the way that the author presumably thinks that the command should output information to you. And I do have to wonder if that is, if that is some sort of artifact of, okay, well, there was this which command, and people expect it from habit to output a certain thing, but we actually think that it should be better, and it should output things this way. So here's the command that you're used to from, you know, I don't know, Unix, you know, BSD 4 or BSD 3 or something, or Unix System 5 version 2, but here's how we actually think it should work. And just as a reference, just to kind of double check everything, I have this Unix System Command Summary booklet that I got at a used bookstore, and it is from 1987, I believe. 1984, sorry, it's from 1984. And because I just kind of wanted to find out, like, okay, well, is which a very old command, or is it a newer command? Like, where does this fall in the line of traditional Unix? So at least as of 1984, which was available. And it says which, find program files including aliases. It says it was available for the C shell only. And then the syntax for it was which, and then the names of the programs or aliases that you want to find. Now, interestingly, in addition to which, right above it is listed the where is command, which, as you and I both know, comes to us now from UtilLinux. So that kind of tells me that it's not, it wasn't developed by UtilLinux. It's just, you know, this is UtilLinux's version of the where is command, or that other command was anyway. And the options look fairly similar. So it says find sources, binary, or manual for a file. And the syntax is where is, and then some options, and then some files. And you can do a dash b to find only binaries. You can look, you can do dash m just for the man pages, and dash s for just the source code, and so on. So as it turns out, both where is and which are, that they date back at least to 1984, which I thought was kind of interesting. So anyway, let's move on. A better idea, let's go get a cup of coffee, then let's move on. I'm Coffee? I do. I'm assuming that you do too, or else you wouldn't have pressed play. It's an honor system where I tell you to go get coffee. I trust that you've gone to get coffee. The next one in our list is XFS Progs, I think. I'll just actually verify that. Which, and then XFS Progs, yeah. So XFS Progs is the set of tools designed to work with the XFS file system. And just really quickly, I'm going to maybe look up XFS file system for some, just a really kind of quick overview of its history. And according to Wikipedia anyway, it is a high-performance 64-bit journaling file system originally created by Silicon Graphics, that's SGI to us normal folk, back in 1993, and it was the default file system for the IRIX operating system. Now, I've never actually used IRIX. I've heard about it. I know people who have. You know, they've used it. They have feelings about it. I've never used it. I was in an industry where lots of people were on that OS, and so I guess by extension they were also on XFS. And you know, you'll hear people talk about what's good for this and what's good for that, and it's I have a hard time talking about file systems in absolutes because I just don't feel like that many people actually look at studies of file system performance. And then even when some people do, I always wonder about, you know, when we're talking about failures, are we talking about file system failures or are we talking about hard drive failures? And those are sometimes difficult to tell the difference between if you're not actually, you know, really careful in your studies. So XFS, I've used a little bit by default. And the only way that I've used it really is when it comes as the default. And it's definitely the default on Red Hat. I'm pretty sure it's the default on CentOS. And I believe it was the default for a while on Fedora. And it may even still be. I just haven't actually bothered looking lately. But it's a pretty well-supported file system. And I'm certainly not opposed to using it in real life. I haven't done a whole lot with it. And I probably should. I really should. I should turn my attention to XFS and really kind of dig into it and find out how I feel about it. I certainly feel fine about it, but I maybe I'm a fan of it. Who knows? I need to kind of do some real life, not tests so much as just, hey, let's use the thing and see if it performs well. It's got a couple of different features like variable block sizes and extended attributes. Extended attributes is good. It is journaled, and that is very good. Now, if you know about me and my file system preferences, I certainly prefer the journaled file system. I get very nervous when I encounter a file system that is not journaled, and I become pretty suspect of it. But worse than, I guess, not being journaled is not having a file system check routine that can be run against a file system, and there are those that do not. So the fact that XFS does have that is quite comforting on its own. So there are three commands in the XFS progs package. There's fsck.xfs, there's mkfs.xfs, and then there's xfs_repair. Somewhat amusingly, fsck.xfs does literally nothing. And if you do a man fsck.xfs, it says, do nothing successfully. Says that fsck.xfs is called by the generic Linux fsck program at startup to check and repair an XFS file system. XFS is a journaling file system and performs recovery at mount time if necessary. So fsck.xfs simply exits with a zero exit status, so that means it's successful. If you wish to check the consistency of an XFS file system or repair a damaged or corrupt XFS file system, cxfs_repair. And that's all fsck.xfs does, is literally nothing. All right, so let's look next at the XFS repair, which I think was xfs_repair. That says repair an XFS file system. xfs_repair repairs corrupt or damaged XFS file systems. File systems specified using the device argument, which should be the device name of the disk partition or volume containing the file system. So if it's partitioned, then you want to give the partition. If you know for a fact that you didn't partition the drive and it is just on the drive, then just give it the path to the drive. If given the name of a block device XFS repair, attempts to find the raw device associated with the specified block device and uses that instead, which is kind of a nice feature, actually. So there are a couple of different options, rather. There's dash F to specify that the file system image to be processed is stored in a regular file rather than on a device. So if you, for instance, had to make a copy, like a DD or something, of a hard drive because you're afraid that it's failing or something like that, you just made a virtual image of that hard drive or a file containing a file system, then you can use dash F for makefs.xfs to know to look at that file and that it's not looking for a device. Now, some of the options concern different aspects of the XFS file system based on the fact that the XFS file system is composed of three different parts. So there's the data section, there's the log section, and then there's what's called the real-time section. The data section contains all of the metadata about the file system. So it's got like the inodes, the directory indicators, the indirect blocks, as well as the user file data for ordinary non-real-time files, and the log area if the log area is not separated out into its own section. The log section, if it's not internal to the data section, is used to store changes to file system metadata while the file system is running. This is written sequentially during a normal operation, and it's read during a mount operation. When mounting an XFS file system after a crash, the log is read to complete operations that were in progress at the time of the crash. And then there's the real-time section, which stores the data of real-time files. Real-time files, according to XFS.org itself, was originally designed for media streaming requiring predictable latencies. So the term real-time is what you think it is, like real-time meaning like real-time data. Now, the reason I'm mentioning all of that is because in the XFS underscore repair man page, which I've navigated away from now, here we go, there are a bunch of options for that sort of thing. So there's, for instance, dash L to indicate where the log of the XFS file system is located, because you can't depend necessarily, I mean, depending on your setup, but in some cases, for instance, your log data would not be in your data section. It may be somewhere else. And you got a dash R to indicate where your real-time section resides. And I'm assuming somewhere in here you have a dash delta, but you don't. Dash D is repair dangerously. It allows XFS underscore repair to repair an XFS file system mounted read-only. This is typically done on a root file system from single user, immediately followed by a reboot. I don't know where you can define the other part of XFS. I don't see that happening here, but quite possibly that just means that if you've defined the L, the log, and the dash R for real time, then the one that's left over is the rest of the XFS file system. So that might be why there's a lack of an apparent lack of an option there. Let's see, there's dash N for no modify, so you run the repair utility, but it only scans the file system. It doesn't actually change the bits on it. There's the dash capital P option, which disables prefetching of inode and directory blocks. Use this option if you find XFS underscore repair getting stuck or not proceeding. Interrupting a stuck XFS repair is safe. That's pretty much it. I mean, there's other little options here and there, but those are the ones that jump out at me. There's a couple of things about memory limits and a big section on what kind of change, what kind of checks are performed. It's an eight point list, and maybe I'll kind of skim over real quick. So there's inode and inode block map addressing checks. That looks for bad magic numbers in inode, bad magic number in inode block map blocks, extents out of order, incorrect number of records in inode block map blocks, and so on. There's the inode allocation map checks. There's a size check, so that's the number of blocks claimed by an inode being inconsistent with the inode size. There's the directory check, a path name check, a link count check, a free map check, and a super mock check. All of that's done by the XFS underscore repair. Now again, ideally, in theory, none of this is necessary, right? Something goes wrong, something crashes, something goes offline, whatever. You reboot the thing, and during the mount operation, XFS corruption is flagged by the mount, but by the mount process, and MKFS is run on the volume, or the XFS file system repairs itself and then continues. In practice, I've seen that happen. I've definitely seen that exact operation happening. It's not something that you necessarily want to see last for a very long time, you know? A quick MKFS always feels better than a long MKFS, but it does happen, and I've seen it. And that's just from, you know, like rebooting, or rather booting up a server that's gone offline for some reason, Red Hat server specifically. So yeah, I know that behavior, but I don't know a whole lot. I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know that it does happen. So then there's this final command here called mkfs.xfs. And I think you probably, if you've ever made a file system, you're familiar with the mkfs command. MKFS has a bunch of sort of subcommands that get brought into it. So mkfs.xfs is running the mkfs.xfs version of that command. It makes the Linux file system, and specifically in this case, it's been told, well, you're going to make an XFS file system. You can define a couple of different things with this. You can define the block size that you need. You can define a specific metadata with -m. You can define where the data is stored. Remember, data, log, and real-time can be on separate places. So -d defines the data location, -l defines the log location, and then I think -r defines the real-time location. You can define everything else. Sector size, inode size, a label, so if you want to give your hard drive a name, a human-readable name, then you can do a -L to give it a label. And of course, when you issue that command, you're issuing it against either a device or a partition. And I think, ideally, it's against a partition. I mean, generally speaking, Linux prefers you, or expects you to define a partition on a device, and then point a file system at that partition and say, okay, fill that partition up with this file system. That's just kind of the model that has been set forth. Now, you can technically not do that. You could take like a thumb drive and just point makefs.xfs at it, or makefs.jfs, or whatever you want, and or UFS, and fill the entire drive from end to end with no concept of a partition with that file system, and that generally works. Now, UDF, the Universal Disk Format, which is an ISO specification that you'll probably know technically as ISO-9660, whatever it is that I think DVDs use, the UDF format was great. I mean, it was fantastic. I think I've talked about it on this show before. And interestingly, it never did want to partition. I think it did. Accept it if you forced it onto a partition, but it kind of complained. It wanted to be on a device because it was developed, to be fair, for optical media, and because it was developed for optical media, it was cross-platform. Everyone had a driver for UDF. And on one hand, I think many operating systems do. I think there's one that does not, if I'm remembering correctly. Apple just dropped UDF support for some reason. I guess because they aren't putting an optical drive in the computers anymore, so they just figure that no one would ever want to run an optical disk on their OS anymore, and so it's gone. Which is a pity, because UDF was a fantastic cross-platform file system. It wasn't journaled. I don't even think it had an FSCK application with it, so it is a little bit risky, but it sure was nice, because it wasn't FAT, it was UDF. It behaved pretty well on all three platforms, and it just had that driver just inherently. And it's open source. So yeah, that was nice, but it's kind of over. Those days are over now. And I think the show is over as well. This episode, I believe, has reached the end, because I want to save some applications for next time. I don't want to just have one application to cover. in the final episode. So in the final episode, I guess we'll go over X, Z, and Zoo. I've used one, but not the other, so that'll be kind of interesting to experiment with between now and a couple weeks from now. So hey, thanks for listening. Have a great holiday. I assume that's coming up. I will talk to you next time. Order podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Deeper until the gods stand defenseless. Oh my God.